the Mysterious Universe, Season 30, Episode 12. Coming up on the show, we've got the Druidic Antennas of Power, throwing down the Psychic Gauntlet, and MI5's Heart Attack Monsters. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
What are these Druidic Antennas?
I went down a massive rabbit hole today. Remember the last show we were talking about Bibu's new banger?
Oh yeah, it was definitely a banger.
Where he was looking at this discovery from ancient Assyria, this black obelisk from King, what was his name?
Shebenezer
or something.
Something like that.
Some ancient king, some ancient Assyrian king from like 9,000 years ago. And on this black obelisk were panels of what the king was given in, I guess...
As gifts
from the other submissive kings. And one of the big things that biblical scholars enjoy is that one of the kings from the Old Testament is actually depicted nude. Like he's bending down, prostrating to this new king of Assyria. But Bibu noticed in one of the panels there were these weird hybrids.
Chimeric beings.
These chimeric hybrid creatures that were given to the king as a kind of, as a gift. And Bibu went into this whole... epic line of research, questioning whether there were actually these
ancient advanced genetic engineering.
Which we've got into before in previous episodes. We've spoken about all these so-called Atlantis channelers, whether it's Edgar Cayce or Barbara Handclough, that claim they have these past life visions of these weird hybrids, like strange people with scales and all sorts of twisted creations that existed in some ancient civilization.
So how could you build upon that?
Well, I was looking at one of these sources I had in this research, and it was over at this website called enfolding.org, which is run by Phil Hine. And he mostly writes about tantrism, but he was writing about some of these ancient theories of the Aryan invasion. The whole idea that there was a population that invaded India 5,000-6,000 years ago. And this resulted in basically two peoples in India. There were the lighter skinned Aryans and there was the Dravidians, which had the darker skin. And this has been a hugely controversial topic for a very long time. And it's very hard to talk about it because it's such a loaded thing to talk about race and the history of India. And I love this guy, Phil Hine's take on it, because he just goes through the history of how this thinking evolved, where the idea of Aryans came from. Like you think of Aryans today.
Immediately you go to the Third Reich.
You think of the Third Reich, you think of Nazis, you think of, Nordic looking blondes with blue eyes and, blonde hair. And the idea of Hyperborea and some land in the north where the Aryans came from. But the history of the idea of Aryans is a linguistic history. It actually comes from language. And the author here, Phil Hine, he's done a bunch of articles on how you can trace this back to thinkers in the 18th century, the 19th century. We mentioned one of these guys on the last show, this incredibly gifted, philologist who was knighted and then sent to India to be a judge. He was stationed in Bengal. Sir William Jones was his name. And immediately he's like, I've got to learn Sanskrit. So he spends a year or two learning Sanskrit, totally masters it, and he gives a presentation to the Asiatic Society at the time and says, I've made a huge discovery. It turns out that ancient Greek and Latin and Sanskrit come from the same language. They're all connected. They all have the same roots. It's undeniable. And this totally upends this idea that all the language, and this was the idea at the time, all these languages came from Hebrew.
Yeah.
The idea that everything came from Adam and Eve and everything had to have come from Hebrew. And so this started this rethinking in the West of where the cradle of civilization might actually be. And for a long time, it was India. People said, even Voltaire at the time said, clearly India is the cradle of civilization.
So this is clearly being, discovered or, discussed well before the out of Africa theory and certainly before the out of Australia theory.
Yeah, I mean, this is separate to that. This is the origin of civilization rather than
as in man.
Evolution. This isn't about evolution. But as this research continued, there was a bit of a shift where it kind of went from this India mania where everyone loved India and India is the cradle of the civilization. And then it shifted to, like, once the race scientists got involved, they're like, well, clearly it was the Aryans that created this civilization. And they're actually these white people. And then they linked it to race. And then the Germans love the idea. And then there's this whole kind of history of where the meme came from, right? But it's all based on language. And so I started digging into this. And then I found this really obscure, like, side path in all of this. In the early 1800s, when this was all being discovered, this India mania was really at the forefront of intellectual questioning in the 19th century. There were some really notable scholars that said, hang on a second, this is all the same things. This is the same stuff we see in the Celts. And clearly the Celts are connected to ancient India. The Vedic gods are the same as the Celtic gods. Some of the practices are the same. The language is the same. And I thought, what is going on here? So I started to dig into this. And this is where I got into this concept of the Celtic towers. You know, the towers, the stone towers in Ireland?
Yep.
And I'll bring up, have I got an image of one here? You know, many of you will probably recognize these kind of things.
Yeah, I think I looked into the, what was it? It wasn't electromagnetic, but there was something about, was it sun's rays or something? There's something strange about this. When you hold up a radio frequency transceiver next to it behaves in a funny way.
There's all this questioning about what their purpose was.
But inside they're hollow, aren't they?
Yeah, they're hollow. And the weird thing about them is the, I don't know if I've got one. Yeah, the doors are not at ground level. Like the entryways are not at ground level. They're always kind of halfway up the tower. And there's always been this question of what they're for. The conventional answer is they were for defense. But this is quickly overturned because they're useless at defense. I mean, you could just throw one, you know, fire arrow in there and whoever's in there would be smoked out almost instantly. There's not enough space in there to store food for a siege. Maybe for a lookout tower, but then really not defensive. So people have been trying to figure out for a long time what they're for. And coming up in the PLOS extension, as I dug into this and followed this path of research, I discovered that There's this line of thinking that they are from the Druids, these things. But there's a connection between the Druids and ancient India.
Really?
And it's got to do with a science of the ancient world that has long been forgotten.
And some type of demonic science?
Yeah, it connects these towers in Ireland. It connects pyramids across the world. And ultimately, it's tied to Egypt and ancient India.
Interesting.
So that's going to be revealed. It's like a massive rabbit hole.
It sounds a little bit Bruce Cathy.
Started with weird like race science from the 1800s and ended up going into these weird stone towers.
Start with eugenics and just see how you end up.
Yeah, that's how I approach most shows.
That's a fantastic idea. That's great.
What did you uncover today?
Well, after we did that work describing what was not our work, but what Bibu described with the chimeric beings, I thought I wanted to dig a little bit deeper into some of the folklore and to see how much of that folklore kind of has moved into our modern times. And of course, you know, it has. We talk about these, you know, really what are chimeric style beasts. And, you know, that would be, you know, werewolves, Bigfoot sometimes, because sometimes Bigfoot is portrayed as being almost manlike. You know, there's mule people that are coming
mule
up.
Mule people.
There seems to be this combination, this recombination between animal and human, and it pops up a lot.
But like donkey men.
Donkey men. Well, in this particular case, it's a mule woman. But I'll get back to that in a moment. So it's definitely equal opportunity when it comes to these beings. So with these, you know, this in mind, I actually picked up a copy of Werewolf Stories, Shapeshifters, Lycanthropes, and Man Beasts, the Real Unexplained Collection by Nick Redfern and Brad Steiger. And the reason why I really enjoyed this book. We always like Nick's work, and I'm a real big fan of Brad Steiger. But the reason
this
why
is new, no, this must be old because Brad Steiger's not
Brad
with
Steiger's.
Us.
Yeah, he died 2 or 3 years ago.
When
now
did this come out?
So this came out just on the 12th of September. So it must be just collections of, you know, because there is, and this is why this book is really great, because it's not just a collection of old tales, even though there's plenty of those in there, which is just great and ripe for the picking. It's a collection of stories of people that have spoken directly to Brad Steiger and have explained their experiences, you know, really also boots
it's not
on
just,
the ground kind of stuff.
It's not just folklore, it's modern,
it's
contemporary
modern,
sightings.
Very much so. And this stuff is continued. And then it starts tying into things like British intelligence using monsters.
Strange. Your headline has MI5. What's MI5's heart attack?
I don't know if it's MI5 specifically, but according to a source connected to, you know, some of these stories, he reckons that it's British intelligence had used monsters to kill people.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. You've got people trying to summon the beasts of Aleister Crowley that end up being strange werewolf-like creatures. You've got all these stories, a lot of these stories that we know, but with these whole new angles on them. It's really quite intriguing.
So there's like a James Bond movie waiting to be created where instead of being this, you know, really capable spy, he just turns into a werewolf and starts killing his enemies. Well, no, is that what it is?
They don't particularly turn into werewolves, but they use rituals to summon entities to utilize them to cause trouble. And that will all become
apparent. I love this idea that instead of just using a gun, you do this elaborate occult ritual.
That's exactly what he says. This is exactly what he says. He says that it's too obvious if you use a gun or, although in saying that, you know, like what, where you can go, this is a little bit ridiculous, is that we know that, you know, intelligence agencies, you know, particularly from the US, they've spent huge amounts of black budget money creating, you know, in weapons that can kill people without leaving a trace and, you know, poisons and toxins and all that kind of stuff. So, is it that much of a stretch to think that they may engage in occult activities to be able to?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is that much of a stretch.
I don't think it is at all. I really don't. But that will become apparent as we go into these stories. So let's just jump straight into the book because I'm looking forward to getting into your plus extension later on, Ben. But I've got to start off. You may be familiar with this story, but I've got to highlight this because this kind of, you know, demonstrates what happens to a lot of people in this field. And, you know, Nick points out that when he was in, I think it was when he was still living in Britain, it's 2002, it's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and Nick wakes up to a presence in the house. Like, he just has this feeling, he knows that there's something in the house. And of course, you know, naturally you want to go and check on what it is. But as he goes to get out of bed, he realizes that he can't move. He's completely paralyzed. And obviously, even back in 2012, he's knowledgeable about things like sleep paralysis and the old hag. And I can only begin to imagine what was going through his mind. And as he's laying there, he says this beast, this huge, hulking wolf man of a beast, that's the only way to describe it, walks through the bedroom door, but it's wearing a cape. Like, it's wearing this long black cape. It's got these fiery red eyes. And he says it seems like it's pissed off. Like, it's pissed off about something, and he doesn't know what.
Obviously. And he's wide awake. This isn't.
He's absolutely wide awake. He says he's half awake, but he knows that he's not dreaming. And as he's lying there and he's paralyzed and he's trying to get through this hulking thing is standing over the bed. And you can go, yeah, look, this is one of those hypnagogic events that people experience. And Nick does a lot of this research, so now no doubt somehow this is, you know, being created in his mind, and it's some weird mind matter thing.
Conventional explanations for it, but Nick, it never covers.
Never.
Everything that happens with the phenomenon, it doesn't explain everything that goes on.
Yeah, and I totally agree with Nick. He points out, quite rightly so, that he's like, I believe that this is not some type of weird mind matter, that there are these external entities that are somehow invading into people's worlds. They're coming into their bedrooms. And because Nick's looking into this stuff and it's pissed off. And he says he tries to move, and this is what we hear in a lot of the sleep paralysis experiences, though, is that when a person is experiencing sleep paralysis, if they push hard enough with all of their might or their mental might, if they can just move anything just slightly, like just make their pinky kind of move, they'll break the spell. And he said that's exactly what happened. He said this thing just kind of shuffled out of the room and was gone, and he broke the spell and was able to jump up and look to see what this thing was. And of course, there was nothing there. But in saying that, he said that the house for at least 3 days was left with this foreboding, angry atmosphere that was there. And I thought, this is intriguing. You've got a man who is researching these stories, and it's almost like he's getting a warning. It's not as far as the Men in Black experiences, although I do have something similar to that coming up with beings appearing in Men in Black style experiences, but it's almost like he had stumbled onto something that the phenomenon doesn't want people to know. And when it comes down to these stories of werewolves, especially with the more modern stories, it appears to be that it could be some type of occult knowledge, where people are actually shape-shifting using these occult practices. And so did he stumble across something that he was going to blow the lid on, and this thing got ticked off? And I'm not saying necessarily that it's the intelligence itself that sent it after him. Was it a group?
Maybe it was MI5.
Maybe.
An MI5 agent.
Maybe. So let's start with the bridge and the shapeshifters. And you know, I'll bring up this first image for me here, Ben. So in this particular image here, and I'll just get the exact details. This is from Elm Creek. So this is Elm Creek in San Antonio in Texas. And this has a really fascinating history behind it. So there's a lot of stories that have been changed over the years, and there's different kind of versions of this story that are out there. And it's really morbid. It's really quite quite horrible. But Nick has really given the most succinct, I think, story out of all the ones I looked into today that describes this incredible experience that people allegedly have with the donkey woman or the mule woman of this bridge. Now, fascinatingly enough, if you're familiar with some of these stories, you notice that these entities, these strange entities that always seem to be on the outskirts of cryptozoology and high strangeness, show up at bridges. You've got, you know, the mystical man monkey of the Shropshire Canal. You know, you've got
classic.
Yeah, classic story of like a ghost ape like thing that comes along and attacks a guy and he hits it with his whip and then the whip goes straight through it. You know, you're absolutely right, Ben. Classic story. But with this mule story, it goes back to the late 19th century and it relates to a young family that lived not too far from this bridge. And this family encompassed a man and a woman and two children. And everything was pretty good. I mean, they lived a simple life and things were fine. And as they're living their life, there apparently was this local tyrant. He was the son of a wealthy merchant or something like that, someone with a bit of power. And clearly this child had been raised in a bad way. And he was a young man by now, but he was essentially evil. Like he was just a sociopath. He would quite happily beat animals whenever he saw them, even killing them in some of the reports. And on this particular day, he had been going past their homestead, this family's homestead. And as he goes past, he sees a mule just sitting outside, just happily eating grass, doing what it does. And for whatever twisted and sick reason, he gets out of his vehicle or whatever he's going along in and runs over and starts beating up this mule. Like, why would you do that? Like, just starts punching up this mule.
Yeah.
And the mule starts reacting. Like, it reacts as you expect it would. And they come running outside, you know, the man and the woman. And as they run outside, they try to stop him. And as they try to stop him, they can't. And he's just wailing down on this donkey. So they start throwing stones at him. And these stones hit him and injure him and piss him off. And so because he's pissed off, he kind of turns around and says to them something along the lines of, I'm going to make you pay for this. And, you know, you don't know who I am and who my father is. And this is going to be a big problem for you. So he goes away. And they think, you know, obviously they're concerned, but, you know, don't think too much else of it because they don't take any, you know, precautions or steps. But sadly, and this is a really horror part of the story, is that they wake up to find their little homestead alight, you know, later that evening. And this thug had hired some goons to come over and set fire to their homestead. And sadly, the fire engulfed the homestead so rapidly that only they were able to get out and the two children sadly perished in the fire.
Far out.
That's horrible. Like absolutely, absolutely horrible. But I think it's an important element of these stories because, you know, like many of these stories that involve, it's like passion or anger or grief. There's these strong human emotions that seemingly play a role in many of these stories of people shape-shifting or seemingly possessing the ability to possess animals and control them. You know, and this pops up in other elements of the paranormal as well, but these extremely strong emotions play a great deal in these experiences. And so the story goes is that sadly, the mother, so the father also was badly burnt, but the two of them managed to get out.
When is this again?
This is the late 19th century.
Okay.
So he manages to get outside. This is the father and collapses. Like he was so severely burnt that, you know, he only lives for a few moments and sadly he passes away. But the goons are still around and they're, you know, attacking and she manages to flee, but she's burnt. She must have, you know, 90% burns to her body. It's something horrific. But she manages to flee down to this bridge, that very bridge that I showed you before, Ben. And she falls into the water. Her body's never found. It's never recovered. No one ever knows what happens to her. The story gets out, but very soon afterwards, people start encountering a half mule, half woman beast along this bridge. Yeah, I mean, probably not that to that point.
Do you know how hard it is to find a decent, safe for work image of the mule woman internet?
That is actually a good question. And I'd imagine it'd be quite difficult.
This looks like a Rob Morphy image. He's probably sketched this. Hard to find. Maybe. There's another one there, Donkey Lady Lives, San Antonio, Texas.
Yeah, they're all a little bit sensationalized. From the reports that I was reading is that it's just essentially exactly what you would imagine a half mule, half woman to look like. It's a farm.
Now, which half? Is she like a centaur? So it's like a woman's body.
No, it's not
body.
Half and half. It's like what I said about those chimeric beings, where it's like a recombination of the genes or whatever it is.
It's just like a gene. It's just like a donkey with a woman's head.
Kind of. Yeah, kind of. And she appears.
Is there udders or boobs?
Well, I didn't go that far. And we'll have to ask Nick to find out whether or not, you know, what's going on there. But this, you know, sets the scene for many of these types of stories, right? And this kind of, you know, continues throughout this book. And I thought this to be, you know, intriguing because Brad Steiger ended up making friends with a number of Navajo people, and they start describing their stories as well. And what I really like about this is that, you know, when people talk about, you know, they're from a more, you know, traditional or indigenous stance, you kind of get people going, oh, well, then, you know, that's part of their culture. So you just kind of accept it, right? Like straight away, you're like, oh, well, because they're indigenous, they're more spiritual.
It's funny. I was thinking about that this morning while I was driving to work.
Really?
It's funny you say that because I was thinking, you know, right now there's all this debate about, you know, Aboriginals in Australia and people look at their culture and say, look at the amazing culture. And, you know, they've got this connection with the land and the spirits of the land. And, you know, the people accept it, like you're saying, like that's their culture, it's traditional, they accept it. But he asked someone, like, what do you think of fairies? What do you think of elves? It's like, nonsense.
Right. Yeah.
That, I mean, that's our,
a great
that's
point.
Our that, culture.
Yeah, yep, you're
they're
totally
our
right.
Creatures.
Every single culture has these folkloric beings that pop up, right? And yes, even though because, you know, I guess the European culture has kind of moved away. But you know what? And what's pointed out with these Navajo stories is, so have they. Like one of the witnesses that speaks to Brad Steiger, he's like, I didn't believe in any of this. I didn't believe in it. And yet he has one of these experiences. And I think that's actually more compelling as being an event that I believe took place because you have someone who is going, I don't believe in it, but I had the experience. You know, it's like that's more telling rather than, well, you know, you could say from a skeptical standpoint, it's part of, you know, someone's folklore. So that's what they're going to see when they have these experiences.
So what, this mule woman, did she attack anyone or did she,
no,
people just seeing her?
People see her apparently.
Is
but
there any evidence
she,
that the tragedy actually happened or is just an urban legend?
It's kind of an urban legend. And as I said, the story has morphed over the years. So whether or not how true it is, I really don't know. But it sets the scene though of it being, you know, this is a folkloric legend that exists, right, within our culture. Mm-hmm. So with the stories from the Navajo, it's, you know, the second one actually is what was described to Brad Steiger. Let me just bring it up here for you. So there was this young man that was, where was he living? I think it was somewhere, his wife apparently had converted to Roman Catholicism or something like that. So again, you know, another step away from, you know, what you would expect to be their traditional beliefs. Sorry, it was a sister, right? And so she was saying, look, my brother had this experience heading to our grandmother's home many, many years ago. And this was described to Brad Steiger. And, you know, obviously Brad, you know, wanted to know more about it. And she said, well, look, you know, my brother was hitchhiking and it was late one evening. And he ended up getting out of the vehicle at one point because the vehicle was going in the opposite direction to our grandmother's house. And so he's wandering along. It's really, really late. And he comes up to a bus stop. When he comes to this bus stop, he's like, ah, oh, it's still 50 miles to our grandmother's house, my grandmother's house. I might just stay here. It's getting cold. I can just bunk.
Another 50 miles.
Yeah, another 50 miles of walking.
What?
And no one's coming along, right? It's late at night. It's dark. Well, he's hitchhiked to this point. And then he's like, well, because the other car went the other direction, what else can he do? So he decides to hunker down for the evening. And he says, as he hunkers down for the evening, he sees this animal he thinks is a big dog. He just looks, it's like, oh, it's a big dog. And wanting some company for the evening, he starts whistling to it and like clicking his fingers.
Right.
So he whistles and clicks his fingers and this thing comes running up to him. But as it comes running up to him, it gets up onto its hind legs. And he's doing the same thing. He's kind of pulling back going, what the hell am I seeing? He was terrified. He was absolutely terrified. And it says here
it's a horny donkey lady.
Well, no, not quite. He's like, is it a big dog? Was it a big coyote? It doesn't really matter because it had a man's face.
What?
It had a man's face. So much like what you said about the donkey lady, it was a man's face on a large coyote or large dog's
so
body.
So it was still a dog body.
Still a dog body, but a man's face.
Wasn't a man wearing skins?
No. It was definitely, like, he was insistent that this was some type of...
See, this isn't even a werewolf. Like, a werewolf...
It's like a centauric creature.
...is meant to have a wolf-like head.
Right. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And he, like, those Linda Godfrey-style reports...
It's actually like a wolf man.
Eyewitnesses describe a dog wolf-shaped head. What is this?
Well, this is part of the greater, I guess, fauna of shapeshifters. Like, because they're never quite... Right. You know, there's obviously like when you look at it as a human being, you go, is that there? How does that exist? It can't exist in nature because it's not natural. It's supernatural. But in the way that it's created, I don't know. But I mean, he said that also the face was painted with little white dots, which kind of indicated maybe that this was part of a ritual that had been performed. And later on, he found out and he says, look, I never believed in such creatures until that moment. But then some medicine people had told me that they really do have the power to travel long distances as a wolf or a coyote.
So it's like a skinwalker again.
It's a skinwalker, yeah. But it was using it to travel along. It just comes up to this guy. Now, he said he went to his grandmother and, you know, he got there. He immediately took off to his grandmother's place, walked the 50 miles.
Did this thing just...
This thing just took off in the opposite direction. It was gone. Like, no threat. And this is one thing that does come up a lot in these...
He didn't have any sausages in his pockets?
No, nothing like that. Like, this thing just was
Give
gone.
Give it some kibble.
Yeah. You know, that's why if you hitchhike and carry some kibble. Kibble and bits, you'd be fine for shapeshifters. So, yeah, he went and told his grandmother, and his grandmother was just like... She wanted to sing it away. There was like a ritual of singing it away because there was a belief that there was potential for evil here. And this is something that was repeated by Manuel. So Manuel was also a Navajo man who described his experiences to Brad Steiger. And he said that his grandfather, whose name was Esteban, had an experience back in 1909. So Esteban was only a 15-year-old young man. And he was a like a sheep herder, that kind of thing. And this was on, apparently wasn't too far from the Arizona-New Mexico border. And he said apparently he would stop at this small hut that wasn't too far from his home. And one particular day as he came to this hut, there were these two beautiful young women that lived there. One was called Isabel and the other one was called Carmelita. And he said they gave him some cool water and they gave him some bread. And it's funny, immediately I start seeing the parallels. And you mentioned, you know, fairy folklore there, Ben. It's the parallels between, you know, English or European folklore and what's happening here, because these just seem to be, you know, normal women. But they're giving him water, they're giving him bread, like, don't drink the drink, don't eat the food. And he has no reason to think that there's anything odd going on, but they're really attractive. And so what does he do? He goes home, he's a 15-year-old boy, of course his hormones are racing. Mm. He sneaks out at night and he starts repeatedly sneaking out at night to come back to this hut to hang out with these two girls. And he's doing, he's hanging out with them. It doesn't say exactly
hanging out with them,
but it doesn't say exactly what else happens, but...
Sitting down playing Scrabble.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing. But he said that as he was slipping out at night...
This is a missed opportunity to have some saucy AI images. You need to get onto the Midjourney, my
I will
friend.
Get onto Midjourney. I didn't have time today, but I will. Although he did say that he had exciting company with them, but they also sang songs that he'd never heard anywhere else. And apparently as they played the guitar, they seemingly were displaying great powers that come along apparently with these witches and shapeshifters. But he doesn't worry about this. Like, none of this is on his mind, right? So he cherished these nocturnal hours that he spent with these beautiful sisters, but he always left the hut before midnight. So very Gremlins-esque in this. He's always leaving before midnight so he could get back home before his father, you know, would call on him coming home late from work to check on him. But on this particular evening, he said that it became increasingly difficult to leave because the girls would tempt him to stay after midnight. And they would keep on, like, obviously offer up a little bit of, you know, nookie and whatever else was going on.
Another game, another round of Scrabble.
Another round of Scrabble, exactly. Until finally, he's like, no, I've got to go. And he went after midnight. Now, nothing happened because it was only moments after, but he got back home and his father was there and his father was pissed. He was just like, where have you been? You've snuck out of the house. Like, this is extremely foolish. This is a really, you know, dumb thing to do, going and hanging out with these you know, hussies. And he's like, well, I don't care. You know, I'm going to go out. I'm going to go anyway. So he runs
away. Did he start to be physically affected in this story?
It doesn't say that, but I get this feeling that there's at least, like, he's now disobeying his father or disobeying his elders. You know, he's feeling a compulsion to go back to these girls. And he does. Like, it's more so than just a 15-year-old boy. Mm. You know, normally, and because this kid's a sheep herder. Like, it seems like quite obvious that he's been raised well and he's behaving, but all of a sudden he goes off the rails when he starts hanging out with these two girls, right?
There's lots of parallels with these stories in fox folklore in Japan
Absolutely.
And China.
Yeah.
Where the local guy comes across a maiden and, yeah, he sneaks away at night and he basically spends the night with her. Or in some versions of the stories, the beautiful maiden will sneak into his bedroom at night and they obviously make love. But the family members notice that over time, and this will go on for weeks, he starts to look gaunt, mm-hmm. he starts to look drawn.
Draining him.
He becomes pale, he becomes weak. And eventually, in a lot of the stories, he figures it out. He figures out that it's a fox.
Well, this wasn't said directly, but you kind of can infer that it's very similar. And indeed, Nick picks up on that because he does have a chapter or so on the kitsune or the fox spirits right. of China and Japan. You know, which are the same kind of thing. And of course, what do? They shapeshift. Like apparently their normal form is that of foxes, but they shapeshift into these, you know, lovely young women that, you know, steal the essence essentially of men and bring down entire, you know, civilizations. But with this particular story, he ends up going back to this girl's hut late one evening and he's knocking on the door and he's disappointed to discover that there's no one inside. Like the girls are gone. But there's half a dozen very large cats.
Oh, gross.
Like cats. Like very large though, like abnormally large cats. And he's like, this is weird. They begin to yell fiercely at him. These creatures were like homeless strays that had invaded their kitchen in search of food.
Are they like witches' familiars or
yeah,
something?
Maybe.
Is that the implication?
Well, he points out that out of frustration and disgust, he actually kicked one of the cats, right? He kicked this cat. And he said the six stray animals immediately attacked him. Like, it was on top of him. He's just being attacked by all these cats. And as these cats are attacking him, he said that he dealt deadly kicks, powerful kicks into these creatures, and they're still attacking him until finally, as they're on top of him, he leans over behind him and there's a rock on the floor. He grabs this rock and he smashes it into the head on one of these cats, and they finally, you know, run away and they're gone. And he goes home and he's, you know, beaten up by these six massive cats that he's been mauled by. I mean, it's not the equivalent of a Bengal tiger, but pretty close. And he gets home. And of course, the following morning, he goes to call on, you know, Isabel and her sister. And so the door opens, like he knocks on the door and the door opens. And rather than being these beautiful young women, it's this angry old woman. And she's like, you're no longer welcome here. And he's like, who the hell are you? And she's wearing this shawl, right? And he's looking, he's trying to understand what he's seeing. And he says, her head was bandaged. And it was directly in the spot where he had smashed the cat in the head with the rock. And he realized, he noped the hell out of there because he realized that he said his senses just completely went crazy. He recalled from where this creature had sunk its fangs into his leg that it started like pulsing and it just like he knew immediately these were witches.
Yeah, it's like a variation of the old werewolf story where they get shot by a silver bullet or something.
Yes.
And then the next day a guy in the village has a limp.
Many of those stories, you know, are mentioned in this particular book, so I won't go into that. Although there is actually something similar.
Oh, fellas.
Here we go. Have you created
something?
Take a look.
Oh, that's the wrong one. Yeah? Hmm? She spent a bit of time on her donkey ears and her hair. That's a very sexy donkey woman there.
I need that gif of the Chinese guy with all the people on top of him. He's like, wood! I'll find it, put in the show notes.
Or this one, yeah.
No, I think I have to go back.
You like
that? If you're going to go,
so you're more of an actual mule face kind of guy. Like Aaron's more of a mule.
I'm more of a personality kind of guy, okay?
It's like that old question of if you want a mermaid, you know, which half do you want to be the fish? This is like the same question, but...
Well, hang on a second. Doesn't that make sense, though? Just one second. Don't you want the lower part to not be fish? Like, wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah, but some guys... It's a hard question for some guys, especially when you're talking about a mule. And clearly you made your decision when I showed those two images, which we'll put in the show notes. Your decision was rapid.
I've been reading this book all day. I've had moments to sit and meditate and contemplate what end of the donkey that I would look at. Anyway, moving back on to, you know, and I like that I, you know, had tried to compare these stories because this book is really well put together in the sense that it kind of follows this flow. But I've mixed things up a little bit because you can jump from these stories that come from one culture, one group, on opposite sides of the world, and then you find these parallels, you know, and as you know, rightly pointed out. So then we come to this story from Dardo, which is near Wittenberg in Germany. And this is the story of the wolf strap or the fox strap. And it's a very old story. I think it comes from the late 1800s, maybe even earlier. But the crux of the story is that there apparently lived this woman who was able to take a strap, and it was like a piece. I don't know if it was actually a piece of fox or something, but it was this strap kind of thing. And if you strapped it to yourself, it would allow you to transform into some other type of beast, like a fox-like beast or a wolf-like beast. And so she would use it all the time, and she would use it to stock her larder or her basement full of wild animals. I shouldn't say wild, you know, farm animals. Mm. She'd bring in geese and ducks and all this kind of stuff, and chickens, and keep, you know, plenty of game downstairs in the basement. And so one day her grandson came along, and he was really fascinated by this and asked if he could bring it to school. And actually, I don't even think he asked. I think he found it in the hiding space and just took it to school. So he takes it to school. And as it happens, the schoolmaster comes across these kids, you know, chatting about witchcraft and the ability to change things. And he grabbed hold of the fox strap and strapped it to himself in this childlike kind of manner. And it's
claimed.
What is
a fox strap?
So it's like, I don't know if it's an actual piece of strap, but it's an item. It's like an amulet, essentially, which is imbued with some type of magical spell that allows the wearer to take on the form of whatever the item is. So in this case, a wolf or a fox, like it's from the pelt, I believe. And this is what you were describing, Ben, with those stories of...
Is it like a tassel?
I don't know if it's a tassel. It's just more of a strap. Like it's like a belt kind of thing.
If you search straps for yourself. Image search for fox strap, everything's a bloody sex toy.
Ugh. Okay, no. It's nothing like that. So immediately the schoolmaster starts transforming before the children into a fox. Like he actually adhered to his flesh and instantly transformed him into a fox, according to the story. So the children began to scream loudly in terror, and it must be earlier than the 1800s. It must be the 1600s where this occurred. Mm. But they're running away, and obviously they go and tell their parents. And this mild-mannered, you know, schoolmaster is completely unaware of his transformation, and he becomes frightened and he runs away. But he runs away as a fox, and he runs off into the forest. As he runs off into the forest, these hunters later on go after him. Now, when they go after him, they ended up shooting him. Well, they shoot him, like a group of local sportsmen that, you know, were out there looking for this thing. They shot him. And as they shot him, they came across, which they thought at first was a fox, but they came across the body of a naked man with this fox strap lying next to him. And they realized that it was the schoolmaster. So it's like this, I guess those magical stories you hear of like the leopard people is one example. The lion people come up as well from Africa, stories of shaman, witch doctors being able to, you know, transform.
These are folk tales. You said you had contemporary reports.
Yes.
Like stuff that happened yesterday.
Well, not that happened.
A couple of weeks ago.
Stuff that happened, let's go 20 years ago, but
okay.
Still, you know, quite, I guess, contemporary when we're talking about these types of stories. So I want to bring up the story of Colin Perks, right? And now Colin Perks' story is intriguing. He died prematurely from a heart attack while walking around the fence line of Stonehenge in 2009, right? Now, look, people die of heart attacks all the time, more so these days, but, you know, it's nothing in it, right? Nothing in it. But he was a young, fit man. It didn't make any sense as to why this guy would just suddenly drop dead. And when I say young, he was young for having a heart attack. But for Perks was obsessed with the myth of King Arthur. He became the student of Arthurian lore. And he believed that the stories of King Arthur were actually based upon the exploits and battles of a very real ruler of that name. So he followed clues. He believed that there was a series of complex codes and ciphers, very Da Vinci Code kind of thing,
yeah,
where he could find King Arthur's grave, right? And this all started back, I believe, in the late 1970s when this actually kicked off. And he was on this obsessional mission to find this final resting place. And of course, the location ended up being somewhere in the vicinity of the old English town of Glastonbury. So look how Arthurian that is in itself. I mean, it's beautiful countryside there.
Just go walk 10 metres in any direction, you'd find a sword buried
That's
somewhere.
That's right. Yeah. Just a knight's armour ready to go. It's around.
An old wand hidden in a tree.
That's right. So he said late one evening though, and this is what he told to Nick Redfern in September of 2000, he actually spent the day digging in the woods. Like he was convinced that in these woods somewhere, but look, it's such a huge swathe of land. But he managed to get home and he was exhausted, and he receives this very weird and what Nick describes as somewhat disturbing phone call. And it's this woman on the other end of the line, and she made it very clear, she was very forceful, that she wanted to discuss with him his situation and his understanding of Arthurian nature. And he was kind of like, yeah, okay, you know, that's fine. And she's like, no, you don't understand. You're not going to, you know, just, you know, palm me off. I'm coming to see you and we're going to talk about this. He's like, okay. And he agrees. Several nights later, he'd arranged a time of 7 p.m. Precisely at 7 p.m., there's this knock at the door, like precisely. And he takes a deep breath and he opens the door, according to Nick. And he was confronted by what can only be described as this, not a donkey in black, a woman in black, right? This is woman in black. She was beautiful, 35 to 40 years of age, dressed in this smart and expensive looking outfit. She had long, full-bodied hair, but her skin was pale and it was smooth, like it was very smooth. And there was this moment of silence because Perks was kind of like just taken back because this is something off. It's almost—
What's off about her?
There's nothing directly, but he just feels like there's something off, right? And, you know, he's captivated, but also intimidated and, in fact, downright frightened by this woman standing at the door. And her face was completely emotionless, completely.
She's like a robot.
But almost in a way, he said there's this air of hostility that is surrounding her. There's this aura of hostility surrounding her. So he says, okay, come in, come in. And she introduces herself as Sarah Key, which is kind of an odd name when you think about it. It's kind of like if you're going to come up with a name, you kind of like look around, you're like, oh, Sarah Khaki Key, you know, like that's what she's kind of done.
Sarah Doorknob.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sarah Picture Frame. So she comes in and immediately she wants to know exactly what he and his colleagues have been, you know, getting into, what they know. She insists that she knows everything that he's been doing.
Wait a second. This guy isn't looking into UFOs,
no,
right? He's looking into Arthurian legends.
Yeah, into the legend of King Arthur, right?
What is going on?
And he's taken aback, as you would be. And, you know, he's kind of starts laughing because he becomes defensive and he responds that, look, there's no way that you know what I've been doing or where I've been and I'm not going to tell you and you're not going to stop me. But she's like, you are not to find his burial site. And it's not even a grave. It's this tomb chamber. Like it's this underground chamber and you're not to go anywhere near it. And he's like—
Is he intimidated?
Yeah, he's still intimidated, but he starts to back off because she's like making these, well, not making these jokes, but he's joking or laughing at her because she's kind of being, she's so serious that it's absurd. Like it's completely absurd. But then she starts like, on Monday you were at this restaurant, you ate this, on Tuesday you were here, you had this phone call, on Wednesday. And he's like, how the hell do you know that? Like how? So unless these people were following so closely and practically next to him, how is it that they knew this about him? So this is where like the jovial nature just drops off.
Is there any other mention of the weird commonalities we hear in Men in Black stories? Like is her suit ill-fitting?
No,
she's
nothing.
Super
no.
Pale.
Very super pale is the only thing that comes up and so this air of hostility.
Otherwise, she just looks like a mean woman in a business suit or something,
but,
right?
But very intimidating, extremely intimidating, which is consistent with these Men in Black stories. So, you know, when she says this stuff and she says, look, it's this chamber and it's no ordinary resting place. In fact, it was built atop, and she tells this to him, it was built atop a paranormal gateway or portal to another dimension. And I quote, and it's been, within it dwells a hideous and terrible beast.
Wait, what? Where's this? What?
So she knows where it is and she's essentially been assigned to stop him from discovering it because if he discovers it and opens the door, it's going to open up a Crowley portal, basically. And this Crowley portal, all these beasts will come flying out. And
so this is the most dangerous portal in the entire world and opening it is like Pandora's box.
Pretty much.
And they send a woman in a business suit. To just talk to this guy?
Well, no, she's
like give him an HR reprimand.
Well, I mean, that could be terrifying.
This is your first warning.
But I'm being too light with it. I mean, he clearly is terrified. And in fact, if you've read Nick's other books, and he's got a full book on Women in Black, you know, they are. It's easy for us to talk about it right now, but actually, in the moment, with this person being at your door and knowing this information about you, it's extremely intimidating.
That's why I'm asking about. You know, the other effects. Did he feel this strange fear? He didn't understand where it was from. Did he feel mentally controlled in any way?
That's not said.
Was there a strange vehicle waiting for her that didn't make any sound? You know, those classic stories.
None of that's included, but it does say here, in fact, that her tone became downright menacing and her face turned grim in the extreme. She explained to Perks that if he did not give up his quest, that he would receive yet another visit from HR. No, just yet another visit. But from who or what was not made entirely clear. And now we know this with these Men in Black kind of stories is that it's just that first experience is enough. But this guy, he's obsessed. He's obsessed. There's no way.
He's not going to let it go, right?
He's not going to let this go, right? So 2 months later, like, she leaves, and, you know, she, like, before she leaves, though, she also says, look, there are these foul things from strange realms that will enter our world if you keep on dabbling and digging in here, and you might be innocent and earnest in what you're trying to do, but if you do this, it will result in a catastrophe and carnage of a magical consequence that you could never possibly comprehend. Like, it's a big warning.
Calm down.
It's a big warning. So he's like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever, you know, the woman's gone. But 2 months later, almost to the night, he says it was late, and he has this terrifying encounter. He was driving back to Glastonbury from the city of Bath, and he said, this is going through the county of Somerset, which is already, you know, connected with strange beasts and beings and other occult activities. And he says, suddenly, this bizarre figure just materializes on the road ahead of him. Now, this is a small and winding road, so he was only going about 25 miles an hour, even less, if that. And he's able to slam on the brakes, and right in front of him is what can only be described as a gargoyle. It's a
what
gargoyle.
What's going on?
It's this gargoyle. He says it's a tall, man-like figure sporting nothing less than a large pair of bat-style wings and a pair of blazing red eyes. So he's hysterical, as you would be. You know.
Is this the woman in her true form?
Well, he wonders that, but he doesn't wonder that until later on because the encounter doesn't end here. So he says that he hits the accelerator and this creature just vanishes before his eyes, before he can run it over. And I'm like, you know what? He's a man after my own heart. This is what I would do. If I come across a gargoyle standing in front of me on the road, I'm not going to swerve around and be like, yeah. Oh, I better go around.
You swerve towards it.
Run it over. So he does, but he takes off and this thing just vanishes before his eyes. Now, a week later, not too long after midnight, he was awakened from his sleep by this horrific sight of the gargoyle looming menacingly over his bed. Like, it's in his bedroom in the middle of the night. He's paralyzed with fear. The creature's gripping his wrists and holding him down and, you know, giving this telepathic message apparently to him to stay away from the woods and to cease looking for King Arthur's chamber. And he's like, okay, like, I'm not going to stop. You're not going to scare me. Like, I'm not going to stop. Even though he was terrified, he wasn't going to show the fear. And clearly this ended up being quite grave for him because he came to believe that Sarah Key, in his very own words, this is without Nick putting these words into his mouth, he says that this was a woman in black. And the gargoyle was not just connected with Key, it was Key. It was some hideous supernatural shapeshifter that could take on any form it so desired. And that's what it did. It showed up as a woman, as this woman in black. Maybe it, because it maybe not totally doesn't understand human society. So it was just like, oh, if I show up as a woman and, you know, wear like a little black dress and, you know, maybe, but like she was a bitch. Like she was a real nasty bitch. She's like, well, I'm not going to, you know, listen to you.
But this connects to the idea of ancient treasures being protected by spirits.
Yeah, treasure guardians.
Yeah, they're treasure guardians.
Yeah, treasure guardians. But it then starts crossing into shapeshifters. And that's what seems to come up in many of these stories, right? If there's some type of occult practice. And apparently there are these groups. There's these hidden groups that somehow possess the knowledge of how to control these entities or how to actually themselves turn into other creatures through the same mechanism.
Wasn't that the old the old bargaining that they did in the Middle Ages?
Yes,
you're
right.
Is there were spells so that you could interface with the spirit and bargain with them to get the treasure?
That's right, yeah. But it never ends well. It's like those old stories of doing
a deal
with the devil.
Sometimes you get the treasure.
Well, very rarely. And in this case, he dropped dead. He dropped dead 8 years later while hanging around Stonehenge.
Yeah, but he's a multimillionaire because he got the treasure.
I don't think he got the treasure. Obviously, we don't know anything about King Arthur actually being real and we never found his tomb. Although in saying, look, the way that the world's gone, maybe he did open the tomb. Like maybe he did open the chamber and these horrible supernatural beasts are now engulfing the planet. I mean, look where we are. Maybe this is what happened. But essentially, the other suggestion is he was just terrified to death. Like he was so terrified by this that ultimately it just overwhelmed him and, you know, this is what was the result from it. But then there are other stories. Right? So this was told to Nick Redfern back in 2001 directly. But there are other stories of people that have had, you know, similar encounters with what appear to be groups possibly that know how to utilize this power or this. So let me just bring this up for you here. So I've got a lot of my notes across here. Actually, I should mention this one for you first. This is the strangest. Thank you. That's great. That's not helpful as I go through my notes here.
Sorry.
That's fine. So actually, let me tell you this story first, and then I'll come back to the group, which might be connected with, you know, the intelligence agencies. Not directly being the intelligence agencies, but certainly outsourced by them, I guess is the way to
describe
it.
Okay, here we go. Strap in, folks.
So I'll come back to that.
I'm just going to sit here working on my hot donkey images. you tell the story about MI5 conjuring demons.
Look, I'm already repulsed by your attraction to mole people. Do you have to start mixing it in with donkey people?
Fellas, come on.
No. I mean, I know that some people are quite indiscriminate.
That's your taste. You said you liked the donkey face. That's what I made. The donkey face and a human body.
Moving on. So this is the story of, it ends up being like an intergenerational kind of thing. We don't have the full names of these people, but it starts off with these three young couples. And these three young couples, they're trying to save enough money so that they can buy a house. And they decide to live together in this one particular house and until they can obviously maybe get enough capital and move out. So they move into this house. And immediately after moving into this house, there's something that's just off. Like there's something that is... not necessarily completely to the point of a haunting yet, but there's a bad feeling and, you know, it's starting to build up and they know that there's something not good. There's these foul, nauseating odors that seemingly come out of the paintwork and up from the basement. And then they said that there was something that would, you know, make ghostly creaks and groans throughout the house. And it became quite obvious to them that they were living in a haunted house. Like it was quite a haunted place. But none of them wanted to leave because, you know, they all had gotten together, they'd invested money and they were trying to wait until the market went up so they could, you know, buy their own homes. So one of the couples, their grandparents, this is a Mrs. M, her grandparents actually come for a visit and her grandmother is just simply, you know, listed as W. So this grandmother W, she's this tiny woman, but apparently she possesses these great psychic abilities, these brilliant psychic abilities. And she walks into the house and immediately she's just like, that woman that's in the painting that's above your mantelpiece that was left here by the previous owners, yeah, she was poisoned and killed in the bedroom upstairs decades ago. And she's still living in the house.
Anyway, see you later.
And so, no, and she's like, you really need to get the hell out of here. Like, you need to get out of this place, this old mansion. And it's haunted, actually not by her. Like, she's around. It's not her. There's something completely inhuman in this house. Completely inhuman. And you have to get away from it. And, you know, they were convinced, yeah, there was something there because immediately as she starts describing this beast, Grandmother W is thrown to the floor by some type of invisible monster, some beast that begins to choke her. Like it's choking. No one can see anything happening. She's just there struggling for air. The grandfather says that she starts turning blue and rushes over to her and wrenches her free of the floor or whatever was attacking her. And she's okay. Like she recovers. But her voice, she's just like, it happened because I was speaking to that lady. She was like psychically apparently talking to the form in the painting when this beast reared itself up. And she said, it's unlike anything I've ever seen before. It had stiff, wiry, orange-colored hair standing out from its head, its arms, and its torso. Its hands were curved into claws like those of a wolf, and the beast had threatened to kill her and had left cuts on her neck where the claws had gouged her flesh. It actually had done that. It had done that. So it was like a kind of a Clarita Villanueva kind of, you know, experience where there's an invisible beast, you know, attacking her, but leaving actual physical trace evidence. And so, you know, she's like, you have to get out. You have to go. And none of these couples want to leave. That is, of course, until one of the couples, Mrs. N, that night is attacked by a huge, large bat that climbs into her bed.
Oh, my God.
So this bat, it's actually not like, when I say huge, like it's a big, like flying fox-sized bat that somehow manages to get in the bed. It bites her foot and then she starts screaming. So the other couples come running in. As they run in, they club this thing to the floor. This thing seems to be invincible. It just rises up after being smashed in the face. And then guess what it does? It doesn't fly out the window. It smashes the window to get out.
Like how big is this thing?
A flying fox bat. So like the size of this table.
So like a small dog.
Yeah, it's like it's a big,
wingspan of the table.
Yeah, wingspan like of the table. But it's still a small creature, but big enough, right?
And right. Yeah, actual flying foxes in Australia are pretty scary.
They're actually beautiful creatures, but I love them. They're really lovely creatures.
Oh, really? You'd want to have one as a pet?
Yeah,
home? And
yeah. Have you seen how cute they are?
A little piece of banana in the
air? Yeah, eggs? I have. I've actually fed flying foxes. So they just
It's like a giant rat with wings.
They're beautiful. But anyway, they do carry Hendra virus, which can cause you to have hemorrhagic fever.
I'll make a flying fox hottie image for you then.
No, I'm good, okay? Is this all you use AI for? Okay.
Pretty much.
So after this thing had gone, this grotesque monster is clearly in the house. And they I don't know what happens. It's not exactly described as to what if they leave, but they must leave at some point. All these couples leave. And the grandmother leaves as well, obviously, because she was only visiting. But she ends up having this homestead. Like, she has this homestead, which I don't know how far away it is, but far enough. And it's this ranch house. And it's 10 years later. It's like 10 years after Grandma W has died, you have Uncle Jay.
Uncle Jay.
Uncle Jay is now living in Grandma W's house, right? After she's died. He claims that one evening when one of these couples was staying there, so the couple, you know, of the grandmother, apparently they're sitting watching TV or something when this Uncle Jay comes down the stairs and he's terrified. Like, he's absolutely terrified. And like, what's going on? And he's like, I just saw this weird thing. It was like a monster and had bristly orange colored hair that was poking out of its head. And it was like, it just stepped out of the storage room and then stepped back in. And like, he was freaked. It was describing the exact same entity from a decade earlier that had attacked Grandma W in their house. And it's almost like this thing, right? This is what I was describing at the start of throwing down the psychic gauntlet, is that because she had challenged this thing, it had followed her home. It had gone into her homestead. So that kind of ended there, right? And everything kind of died down about these nocturnal visitations until another decade later. So it's 20 years later.
What is going on?
You've now got the couple, this Mr. and Mrs. M, who are the, you know, this couple that we've been through all these experiences. They are now living in this old ranch and they've got their 9-year-old grandson with them. Now they're looking forward to this comfortable stay. They've, you know, come to stay in the house. And one evening, Mrs. M is awakened by this shuffling sound that was heading towards her grandson. Now, she opens up her eyes, and in the moonlight, there's this moonlight that's kind of shining through the window. She sees this grinning creature with its eyes hidden by these series of mottled lumps of some kind of hair. It's essentially a dogman kind of creature, right, that's in the house lunging towards her grandson. Now, she jumps out of bed and somehow intercepts this thing, right, and grabs hold of a handful of this thick, long hair. She's desperately clutching. It's very physical.
Yeah,
like, until now, it's been invisible. You know, it's very visible. And the grandfather, the grandfather, he jumps up and reefs back the curtains, right, to illuminate the entire room. And when he illuminates the entire room, this beast is like, ah, you know, very typical in the mythology, right? Like, it's vampiric in a way because it's affected by the light. You know what's really strange about this case? You can go, look, you know, maybe this is the kind of story where it's just been like a legend, it's been blown out of proportion, but Nick's pretty good with doing his research and, you know, and finding, you know, the origins of these stories. But there's something that really stands out about this, which is so strange, and it's not what you'd expect from someone making up a story. When they pull the curtain back, when the grandfather pulls the curtain back, he says he sees the beast. The beast, though, is wearing a light-colored, tight-fitting one-piece suit.
What?
With a thin material that ended at the knees and elbows. It's wearing like those weird one-piece alien spacesuits that we hear in so many of these reports of ET beings. And it's like this super modern like space material that it's wearing.
Wait, is he saying that it's not a wolf thing anymore? It's something
else?
It's
still a wolf. It's still like a wolf-like monster, like a humanoid wolf-like monster.
But he's in
but
like...
wearing a spandex space suit material.
He's in like a Lululemon outfit.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like this thing. And he can see this bristly orange-colored hair protruding from its flattened, misshapen face. It's got thick, bulbous lips that are like over a snarling kind of smile. And the thing is like going towards the grandson. But because she had stepped in the way, it couldn't get to him. And it just starts to shuffle back out through the doorway. But when it leaves this sickening odor of decay behind. What are these things? What the hell are these things?
Let's assume that all of this is true. This is a real encounter. Absolutely true. Definitely happened. Why would it need a activewear, like yoga pants suit? What? Why would a werewolf need that? Why would it be wearing that?
I have no idea. Like, this is what is so bizarre about this.
Is it classic kind of transforming lycanthropy where... It was a guy doing yoga and then he transformed or something.
Well, where is it? I'll bring up this other story before.
By the way.
Oh, here we go. Yes, see?
Flying foxes.
Look how adorable they
adorable.
Are.
I see? Take it back.
They're absolutely adorable.
Super cute.
Actually, though, in saying that, like, let me bring this. Okay, I've got this one here. Wolf-like creature wearing pants is my comment here. So this is from February the 22nd in 1971. It relates to 35-year-old Donald Childs of Lawton in Oklahoma. Now, back in 1971 in Lawton, there was actually a spate of sightings, right, of this wolfman-like creature. Now, this poor guy, Donald, he has a heart attack. Like, he actually has a, not as in like the metaphoric heart attack. He literally
pulls open his door
or the curtain on his door to look outside to see a werewolf drinking from his bird bath, and he has a heart attack. And after he's recovering in hospital, people are like, what happened? He's like, there's a freaking werewolf drinking from my bird bath. But not only that, it was wearing bike shorts that were too tight for its body. The thing was wearing these pants that were too small for him. And people are like, this guy's crazy. He's had a heart attack. He's obviously suffering from hypoxia, you know, lack of oxygen to the brain. This is why he's imagining it. But according to the reports, and I don't know if this was a Brad Steiger, it was. This is something that Brad Steiger investigated, right? Without knowing it, there was also a police officer from Lawton, Oklahoma that evening, Harry Edsel, who was in the precinct, who was receiving calls about something monstrous running down the street. It was dodging cars, it was hiding behind bushes, and it was getting up and running again. There were multiple reports of what appeared to be a monster sitting on a railing outside an apartment, wearing pants on the same evening. Who's making this stuff up? Think about it, right? If you're going to say you're going to see a werewolf, you're not going to go to the point of saying, I saw a wolf man outside my house wearing bike shorts that were clearly too small for it. Like, you know, why would you go to that level of detail?
Yeah, it just makes it so Isn't it more absurd than it already is?
It's really strange. So this particular guy who reported it to the police, he said that when it was outside the apartment, it was like 11:15 p.m., which was a couple of hours after the other sighting. He said he thought it was a practical joke because of the fact that it was wearing these pants and the way that it was perched on the railing. He thought maybe it was someone, but he was like, it was like a beastly form that could have been a cross between a wolf and then a monkey or an ape. Like, what is this thing? He said he knew it wasn't a joke when the thing turned around to look at him. And he said it was an obvious face. It wasn't a mask. And then it jumped two stories. But this thing was capable of jumping two stories. And then, of course, there was a group of soldiers nearby at Fort Steele. This is 15 minutes later after this particular sighting. They were frightened and freely admitted that they were terrified by seeing one of these weird wolf-like monsters running past them wearing pants.
Multiple eyewitnesses of this thing.
So I go, what is this? Is this some type of escaped, you know, yeah, well, I mean, Teen Wolf is where it kind of comes up, like the classic werewolf kind of idea that, you know, you involuntarily cursed. And upon a full moon, you know, even in the clothes you're wearing, you'll transmogrify into a wolf-like being, and that's why everything's too tight because your clothing's too tight. Maybe. But I tend to think this is part of the phenomenon. The phenomenon does this on purpose. It adds these little details. It adds these, you know, strange elements to it just to keep people like, huh? You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't want people to lock on to an understanding of what this is. So it deliberately makes it absurd and strange. And of course, people are reporting this. Most people go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. So hang on. Yeah, 911. Oh, what's that? Oh, you had a wolf man wearing bike shorts at the front of your house, did you? Oh, okay. You know what I mean? Like, that's what the reaction is going to be. But when you get people like Brad Steiger, researchers starting connecting the dots on these stories, not everyone can be making this up. Not everyone wants that kind of attention. You know, like, how many people are really going to call a police station to say, look, I saw a wolfman outside my house?
What is it then?
I don't know. There was one story which I didn't include in here, and it's really quite far out. And Nick, you know, admits this. And again, you know, this is, you can't, like, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, so you can't throw everything out. But this guy contacted Nick with allegedly the answer to the whole chupacabra myth.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he's like, well, what is it? And he's like, it's Tasmanian tigers.
What?
And he's like, what do you mean?
It's with spines?
No, well, kind of. Like, he claims that it's a group of Tasmanian tigers that the Americans were experimenting upon because Tasmanian tigers have extremely strong jaw strength, like very strong jaw strength.
When did they go extinct, though?
I think 1930s that these things went extinct. I think the last one died in the 1930s.
There's an image of one in Washington, D.C. Zoo in 1903.
Right, okay. So I think it was, but in saying that, these things, you know, people still claim to see them to this day. Like, there's these anecdotal reports of people saying that they, yeah, I mean, spectacular creatures that they.
Yeah, there's some pretty convincing reports.
Very convincing reports, yeah. I mean, there's also your Rex Gilroy reports of them as well, yeah. But there are, you know, there's people, in fact, I have a friend who claims that she insists, and I believe her, that she saw one of these things in Victoria. She was just driving along and just ran out in front of her, and she was insistent that there was no doubt about it. I mean, they're very distinct creatures, and these things are still around.
Well, it's the stripes. I mean, you could obviously see a wild dog and think, okay, maybe I saw something like that, but
yeah,
It's the stripes that give it away.
So this guy claimed to Nick that what had happened was is that the military had somehow retained, you know, I don't know, genomic samples, something, a breeding population of them. I really don't know. The fact that they allegedly went extinct in 1930 kind of, you know, puts the kibosh on his story. But they were testing these creatures and they had exposed them to some mutagenic virus or something like that to make them more aggressive, far more aggressive. Because what the idea was is that you would get them and then you would release them on the battlefield. And it's, you know, you don't have to send your soldiers out as cannon fodder and they go and they, you know, can tear up the enemy and then you can send your soldiers through afterwards. And it kind of makes sense. We know with, you know, obviously declassified reports now that the CIA and the military has experimented with bats was one good example, cats, that kind of thing. So it's not out of the realm of possibility. But to say, you know, in the 1950s that they used some type of virus to cause them to become more aggressive and, like, did they give them rabies, but then they wouldn't last very long?
It's just the amount of resources you would need for such a ridiculous project.
Exactly.
It's completely,
yeah.
It's completely absurd.
And so, of course, they got loose in the facility, and guess where the facility was? Is Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And so that's why there's all these reports of chupacabra. But then
did I miss the MI5 story? Well, are you building up to this?
I'm building up to this, right? So this is where I'm setting the scene of, like, well, then, you know, maybe there is some, you know, materialistic, natural kind of, and I shouldn't say natural because it's not natural, but, you know, physical experiments that people might do with these creatures to manipulate them. But then we cross into the realm of occult experiments that are run by certain intelligence agencies to utilize these beings to get rid of enemies, right? And so this comes back to a story that relates to a deadly group in Bristol. And this man was by the name of Rob Lee. So Rob Lee... Actually, I'll just bring up the original part of this story. It might help if I do that. So this happened in the summer of 1989. So in the summer of 1989, something very dark and disturbing descended upon the town of Newport in England. And it was along the lines of cattle mutilations. Like, it was this weird cattle mutilation that was happening. There were wild animals that were being attacked, but more so it was farm animals that were being seemingly ritually slaughtered by something, right? It was this shocking, horrible sight. And Rob Lee's father came out one day to find five sheep lying dead in a field, but they were placed in this circular fashion.
Okay, that's all.
And with, you know, consistency with the whole cattle mutilation stuff, their innards were pulled out and removed and were gone, right? Very horrible kind of thing, organs gone. In another particular event that took place, I think this is eight sheep now, three of them were laid out in a triangle fashion, but there was nothing. There was no footprints. There was no trace evidence. There was nothing to, you know, demonstrate what it was. And, you know, for Rob and his father, they were obviously extremely disturbed by this, but they wanted to find out what it was. And at first they thought, well, this is quite obvious. Like, they concluded that this is a group of devil worshippers. It was some type of cult that were trying to, you know, summon something that's quite, you know, quite deadly and dangerous. But it's even worse than that. Even worse than that. So according to Rob, after he spoke to Nick, he had spent years looking into this. The police they reported it to the police. The police were very concerned about it, obviously, because it's, you know, it's just horrible. It's truly horrible. But they found nothing. Like, they couldn't find even a single lead to go on. And after a matter of time, they dropped it, you know, and they apologized to the Lee family, but that was it, you know. So Rob decided to become, you know, an amateur detective, Nick writes, and he spent many years researching, trying to find out what had occurred, like what this group was, what they were doing, why they would do that. You know, these just a group of nutters, but it seemed too, I mean, obviously they're nutters, but it seemed too organized to do that. And so I ended up meeting up with Nick in 2000 and described to him his findings. And he shows, like, apparently Nick said he pulls out this manila folder or envelope and starts, you know, throwing out these photos and all these photos of the it's horrible. Like, there's these 35mm color photographs clearly showing these graphic scenes of carnage. Like, with this group, whatever they were doing, they were just absolutely horrible. And look, he said when he first started digging into the animal mutilation mystery, he said for a while, he was actually a firm adherent to the idea that deadly extraterrestrials were the ones that were behind these attacks.
Right.
Yeah, and this is a really hard thing for someone who's never been involved in any of this stuff before, and then all of a sudden you're thrust into this world where you've got a whole bunch of dead animals on your property, and it's not that they're just dead, but they could have died from eating clover or something. It's that they've been ritualistically slaughtered and left in these weird... It's extremely strange. Like, of course it's going to get you fascinated. So he's dived in the deep end, and he must have looked up the work of people like Linda Moulton Howe and everything, and rightly so, because... It's like, this looks like a cattle mutilation. It's probably aliens. It's the only thing that makes sense.
Well, the first mention that you said the sheep were arranged in a circle, that immediately breaks the pattern.
That's right. Yes, that's not consistent.
Completely different.
With what we know from, you know, research like A Strange Harvest, for example, or even reports that we've got from, you know, other parts of England and Australia. But he said, look, I ended up delving into something even deeper and found something much more disturbing than alien visitations. So apparently, according to Lee, by the end of the 1990s, he had quietly and carefully travelled the length and breadth of the British Isles in diligent pursuit of answers and inadvertently stumbled upon a sinister and deadly group of people based in the English city of Bristol. Right? Lee said that this was the cult of the Moon Beast. Now, he doesn't know that this is exactly their name. He doesn't even know who they are or whatever they call them. But this is what he dubbed them. But he very quickly realized that they performed rites and rituals that related to the sacrifice of unfortunate animals as a means of conjuring up monstrous entities from some vile netherworld that would then be dispatched to commit unknown atrocities on behalf of their masters. Like, this is just... Yeah, like this is...
Nick's latest article, Monsters, Cryptozoology and Secret Societies, which is live on our site now at mysteriousuniverse.org, details the case as well.
Yeah, yeah. He said that, and this is according to Rob, that he eventually, he must have put himself in a lot of danger, but he found out that it was a group of around a 15 people or so. And he followed them for years. And he said that he had clandestinely tracked the movements of the group and had viewed their dark practices, one of which had occurred in the early 2000s in the deep heart of the Cannock Chase. Now, the Cannock Chase in Staffordshire, that's also associated with a whole heap of high strangeness, occult activities, and much so goes back to the idea that here's, look at this, like this is the Cannock Chase. Like it's a vast, thick woodland. You know, it's just a lot of strange things come out of there. So according to Lee, the cult of the Moon Beast actually engaged in these occult rituals because they had taken the information from Crowley, right? They got this understanding from Crowley. So
from Aleister Crowley, from the Aleister great beast Crowley. Himself.
So apparently Crowley, and we know that, you know, Crowley did this with, there's reports apparently of him doing it at Loch Ness. You know, we know this with Boliskin House, that he practiced these rituals to open up these portals and bring beasts through. Well, this group had somehow found out about this as well and were following this to somehow summon some type of non-physical intelligence that could take the appearance of whatever the mind's eye and beholder would, this large, you know, werewolf, right? But why? Like, why would they do this? This just doesn't make, you know, any sense at all. Well, the reason why they would do it is because, according to Lee, after he'd done all this investigation, the cult of the Moon Beast was linked to some very influential people. And they used the cult as a hire for, well, a kill for hire service. They paid very handsomely. And it was used by the highest echelons of private industry and even intelligence services of the British government. If you want someone dead, said Lee, then you give them a heart attack by having a monster appearing in their bedroom at night, or drive them to suicide by making them think they're going mad by seeing werewolves.
So it's not MI6 doing occult rituals. They're just outsourcing it.
That's his claim. Yeah. And it's saying that, like, look at what all these organizations do. Like, they actually do that. So I'm just like, what the hell is going on with these things? Like, it's just... it's absolutely terrifying. And look, there's a whole collection of these similar sorts of reports that are all through this book. It's actually a really fantastic book. And I'll link to it in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can check it out. What I will do as well, in our Plus extension, depending on how much time we have, I might also go into a story from Jonathan Downs. Of course, Jonathan Downs connected with the Center for Tian Zoology, you know, another great investigator who's had, you know, a wealth of great experiences. He actually worked at a psychiatric hospital in England back in the 1980s. And one of the patients that was working there had a truly terrifying story to tell that Jonathan wanted to dig into a little bit deeper and found that he got pushed back on quite rapidly. But it was connected to, let's just say, a very influential family and reports of a couple of werewolves. So we'll go into that a little bit later.
Is this got to do with the Queen?
No, none of the Queen. No, the Queen doesn't come up in these things, but definitely apparently influential families. And you got to, you know, maybe there is something about
Is that the story about the family that had a a retarded child and they kept him locked as like a well-to-do aristocratic family and they had a retarded child and they kept him locked in the dungeon.
I have heard that. No, it's not that one.
Yeah. I told that story in the show and then he escaped and then the villagers were trying to track him down.
That's right.
And it turned into a werewolf story. It morphed into him being this some kind of werewolf.
That's right. Yeah. No, no, it's a little bit different. But it basically is this family, you know, had significant influence. But it becomes, at first, it feels like it's a real letdown. It's just like, yeah, the family just, you know, basically put their children into a mental institution because they got knocked up. Like the 13-year-old girl got knocked up and they were like, well, you're clearly crazy, and had her locked up. But it comes about that the family had other connections that might have been a little bit more occult in nature.
Very intriguing.
Mm. So what have you got coming up in Plus again? Just remind us.
Ancient mysteries, modern visions, 18th century race science.
Okay, great. Oh, good. I'm sure they'll get down a treat.
No, we've got a connection to these strange stone Celtic towers in Ireland, these bizarre conical structures, and no one really knows what their purpose was. I've got one researcher who believes he found an answer and it's connected to ancient India.
Okay.
We're going to follow where this research came from. We're going to follow the connections between, you know, Sanskrit, ancient Sanskrit and Greek and Latin as well. Some of the early thinking around that, how that created the Aryan meme in the 18th century as well. And ultimately, yeah, it leads us to this bizarre connection with the Druids. Fun stuff coming up. If you want to get access, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. Sign up today and you get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. And of course, Plus members get an entirely exclusive show on Tuesdays as well. More than double the content if you sign up for Plus. Plus members also get a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our 15, no, it's like 20 years now. What is it now?
I don't even know. 16 years, I think.
17 years of shows.
I don't know. Somewhere in that realm. You won't listen to it all in this lifetime. So sign up.
I went back and looked at one of our videos because we're doing video now, obviously. If you haven't checked it out, make sure you go to our website. If you're on Plus, watch the video. If you're on YouTube, you can watch the video there for the free show. But we used to do those casual Fridays.
Yeah.
Have you looked at one of those videos in a while? Because they're still archived.
Oh, I was going to delete them, but I thought I'll just leave them there. I've just put them on non-display.
We look like babies. We look like that little flying fox
we're
baby.
We're hardened now and cynical and I like it.
My skin is so round and soft. I'm like a chubby little baby doing podcasts.
Not anymore.
It's just funny to go look at them again.
We're
not going to put them back up again.
No, that's not happening.
Unless you sign up for Plus and MU Max, then we'll think about it. Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. It's $9 a month. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this edition of AMU. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Extension, great to have you.